If he builds it, will they come? Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, the latest on downtown Jacksonville development and all those demolitions on this Earth Day, plus your calls. Give us a call right now and join the show. It's 549-2937. Then later, how Matthew Sandusky is working to protect children and bring awareness to childhood sexual abuse and trauma. We'll speak with the adopted son of Jerry Sandusky as he speaks in Jacksonville this week. Then a little later, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars draft hopes. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, this hour, the new logo celebrating the Jaguars' 25th season actually has an outline of downtown Jacksonville's skyline. So it wasn't much of a surprise last week when Jaguars owner Shad Khan said at the team's State of the Franchise address that he can't wait to get started on adding more pieces to that skyline with his estimated $500 million development he wants to build all around the football stadium. But how do Khan's ambitious plans factor into other urban core moves? Everything from the still unbuilt Berkman Plaza 2 to JEA and its hopes to revitalize the Adams Street corridor and more. It's Earth Day, a day when we honor the environment. And of course, the old saying is that the greenest buildings are ones that are already built. Still, though, the demolition continues apace in Jacksonville with plans for a lot of new construction. David Bauerlein, reporter for the Florida Times-Union, is covering all of these moves, and he joins us now in studio for a closer look. David, always good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and let us know your thoughts on Facebook. Hey, you know what? Before we get into the discussion, our producer, Heather Schatz, pulled a little bit of the Jaguars' latest video, taking us back to those halcyon days when they put together their bid to bring an NFL team to Jacksonville. Let's listen.
You rise up onto bridges over the St. John's River far below. And Jacksonville shines from a number of angles, like a jewel being turned in your hand. Those words were written by Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Updike. Updike had even more to say about Jacksonville. He called it a city of dreams.
Only James Earl Jones could make downtown Jacksonville sound so magical, David. He made it sound like Kevin Costner in the football field, or the baseball diamond, I should say, talking to shoeless Joe Jackson.
And put some John Updike into it. Very impressive.
That's right.
Hits all the corners.
Okay, yeah. So that was interesting to listen to. But fast forwarding to 2019, as you wrote in the Times Union the other day, Shad Khan is champing at the bit to get building around TIAA Bank Field. His vision for Lot J is a really ambitious one. He wants to put up an entertainment complex, a hotel, office buildings, the entire area around the stadium, all the way down to the river and all the way west to the still vacant Shipyards parcel would be built out. And so realistically, is this going to happen? Can we expect his vision to bear fruit? Are we going to see this?
So, yes, I do think that it is going to bear fruit. He's trying to bottle a little bit of that 25th anniversary emotion and can do and let's do it against the odds type of mentality. Yes, I think it will happen. It basically is four components of that plan. One is this entertainment venue where they already have somebody lined up that does these things all over the country and the world in terms of these sort of building with a lot of different places to eat, hang out, have fun. So that, I think, will definitely happen. They say they have a hotel operator. That seems doable. The residential, is there a market for 300 units of residential there? For people who like being in the middle of a sports complex, all that action, that would probably be something that would be appealing to people. If it's tall enough to get a good view of the river, that would be a nice thing. The office building, they don't have any tenants right now. That was one of their hoping to get JEA to put its headquarters building. That didn't happen. So there's a little a missing piece there. But they say they're ready to go. He's obviously got the finances. They're waiting on the city to reach an agreement in terms of an economic development deal because there will be taxpayer money involved.
Yeah, and how much is the question?
As always, would it be like incentives in terms of property tax rebates? How much money would have to be put in upfront? A lot of unknowns in terms of the price tag.
Give us a call. What do you think of Shahid Khan's ambitious plans to develop around the Jaguar Stadium? What would you like to see downtown look like in 10 years? Also, what are your thoughts about plans to demolish portions of the Hart Bridge elevated ramps that run past the sports complex? That's part of this plan, too. It's 549-2937. So this is a $2.5 billion urban village, in effect, David. In order for this vision to be realized, those Hart Bridge ramps need to come down. And that is in motion, despite outcry from urban core activists who say, don't pull down something that's a working, functioning structure. Turn it into something else. Make it into something similar to the High Line in New York City, where they took an old rail line and made it into an elevated garden.
Right.
So the Hart Bridge ramps are the latest example of many instances of structures either on pace or already past the point of just being brought down to rubble, being demolished. That isn't green, and it isn't in line with the way most cities are going these days, which is adaptive reuse, repurposing structures, rather than just demolishing them.
Yeah, interestingly, in terms of the original plan for the Hart Bridge ramp, there was always a plan to demolish and tear down this section that goes through the sports complex. That hasn't changed. And then if you've never been through there, you kind of have to picture when you come off the Hart Bridge and it kind of, you have different splits and it merges and it goes off to different areas. So there's some elevated ramps then that branch out, is the best way to put it, into downtown. At one point, there was a plan to keep half of that for motor vehicle traffic, make it two-way. The other half was going to be like what you're talking about, a place where you'd have dedicated bicycle, pedestrian type of stuff, just for that section there that goes across Hogan's Creek. That eventually got dropped. And the main thing was there's this big concern that people wanted to make sure that if you were driving that road every day, you would have pretty much a similar drive to what you have now. So it ended up where it's all staying for motor vehicles. Could it change in the future? You know, possibly. But the way it is right now, it's still going to stay the same in terms of motor vehicle only.
And Jaguars owner Mark Lamping at the State of the Franchise event said how important he thinks it is to create excitement in the downtown core, to pull people back into the city center from mainly the St. John's Town Center and the beaches, places where people are congregating, where they have an array of options for nightlife and dining, and they have easy parking. So as the Jaguars proceed with this, we're still awaiting the fate of the Jacksonville Landing. As one city councilman has called for a charrette, sort of a public brainstorming session on what to do with the landing rather than just tearing it down as well. And we don't know the answer or what's going to come out of that yet either.
Or even if there will be that public brainstorming session that he's Matt Carlucci has called for that and recommended it. The landing is a work in progress. The mayor favors tearing it down completely and then turning much of it into green space and having a smaller portion of it be for buildings. So that's one scenario. There's other folks who say keep the landing, find some new use for it, but maybe tear down some of it because it's just too big for what downtown can support. A public charrette would be a sort of a case where everybody kind of gets together in small groups and they throw out ideas, they come up with consensus, and then a plan emerges from that based on the people who come there with their ideas. It's fascinating what's going to happen there. I mean, some people say, hey, it's just not Jacksonville downtown without the orange top roofs. Other people say, you know, it had its time, it's done. It's time now to just do a completely new rethink for this really prime property.
And what do you think of the theory that commercial real estate experts have floated, which is that the administration wants to turn the landing into green space as sort of a backdoor way to do a land swap so that they can develop Metropolitan Park? That way they can say that the city hasn't lost any green space, any park space, because you can't officially develop on park space.
Yeah, I've not had a chance to really dig in to see whether that's the case. I mean, there certainly could be that potential. If you the deal at Metropolitan Park, there was this federal grant money many decades ago, and part of that getting the federal grant money was that land had to stay in perpetuity as a public park, with an exception that there was this option that a city could come back later and say, well, we have comparable land someplace else, and we'd like to end that restriction on Metropolitan Park. There's a lot more land at Met Park than there is at the landing space.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can do an acre-for-acre swap there. Possibly that's part of what's driving it.
Let's go to your calls as we talk about lots of different points all across downtown making news this month with David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. What are your thoughts? What would you like to see happen in the urban core? It's 549-2937. Carrera is downtown. Carrera, good morning. Happy Monday. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I was calling to give my 2 cents on the landing and the deal with Shy Khan. I wouldn't mind spending my tax money on it. I'm also a business owner downtown. And I think that...
What's your business? Can you you want to share it? You want to plug your business?
I have a welding construction company and also own a cigar bar downtown.
Oh, cool.
A couple years ago. And the landing was a vacuum. It sucked all the business there, but nothing to do. So the past eight mayors or how many that the landing's been around never filled up, never came, did anything with it. So it was a waste of our money, and I'd rather give it a shot and let him go forward with his plan on that area. It's wasted land. There's no gantry cranes being in Duval at all in the skyline building anything. So we need some construction downtown, and I think it'll look better on that side of town.
All right, Carrera. Thanks for calling in. So downtown business owners like him, I think, I'm generalizing a little bit, but when you talk to them, a lot of them will say, let's just get something going. Let's do something.
Right. Where are the cranes? Where are the cranes? Right. I think there's sense there's a lot of demolition going on. When and where is the new development going to come up? And that's a valid observation. We're still waiting for the second act of all this to happen. It'd be a fun parlor game to sort of lay odds on who's going to break ground first. Is it going to be the landing? Is it going to be the Shad Khan with his development there next to the sports complex? My guess is probably it'll be the landing just because that's something that seems to be a real personal priority for the mayor. And there's less in the way as far as actually getting it ready for development.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call here on the show this Monday morning. Let's go to May on the south side. Hey, May, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Twofold. Quick comment about the landing. To me, it was doomed from the start because there was no parking integrated into the construction. And then about Shad Khan, I love the Jaguars. I love his ideas. But I think we have negotiating tool, and we have Berkman Plaza 2 sitting there incomplete. Can that be part of the negotiation? And he bolts that into his plan.
Yeah, May. My comment. Thanks for that. Appreciate that, May. Okay, let's talk about the Berkman building. For people that have driven by it, it's downtown on Bay Street opposite the county jail. It's this half-built residential tower that's been sitting there like an eyesore for over a decade. There was some embarrassment for the city last week when your outlet, the Times Union, reported that a development firm from Mississippi who put forth a proposal to develop the Berkman has all sorts of judgments against it, a series of red flags that would make people think twice about bringing them in to develop the Berkman.
As well it should. I mean, if you have a half-finished building and you want to bring somebody in to finish it, that'd be one of the ground zero questions. Can this firm finish it? Do they have the financial wherewithal to do it? What is their track record of doing projects? It's mixed. And so those are all really valid information questions that my colleague Chris Helm brought up. On the Berkman, if I can just share a little bit of an anecdote about how long this has been a problem. Many years ago, there was a guy named Tom Murphy, a former Pittsburgh mayor. He was in town, and he was coming here to talk about the great things Pittsburgh had done with downtown development. So I had a chance to interview him, and he hadn't been in town for a few years here in Jacksonville. I said, well, so what do you think about how things are going in Jacksonville in terms of what's your take on downtown development? He said, Well, you know, there seems to be something going on. I did notice there's this, looks like a residential tower that's under construction there. Well, this was after it had been halted and it was just sitting there. It's just been that way for years and years and years. And it really is one of those projects that we'll see if it happens. I mean, it seems like it's got something there that's a good location. You already have part of the building built. It's a mystery why they can't come in and get a good deal that can come in and get it finished.
Well, and let's talk about the fact that the Berkman has sat there for over a decade because nobody made an offer to do anything with it. People actually call it the Beirut Berkman because it looks like a bombed out building, David. I mean, nobody, when we talk about the Jacksonville Landing, we interviewed on this program City Councilman Bill Gullerford, who said he didn't understand why people had a problem with demolishing the landing because nobody's made a decent offer for anything better. But that has also been the argument against demolishing all of these other buildings, because if you demolish a building and leave an open lot, you could wait many years before anybody comes in with a decent offer to do something there. So it's just... the end result is more vacant lots in this downtown that has too many of them already.
Right. So on the landing, I guess that would be one way the city could potentially go out and say, look, we're going to keep the building. Give us your best offer and just put a request for proposal out on that. You know, there have not been any offers to buy that building and reuse it and what the adaptive reuse is. And I've, quite frankly, not heard a real compelling argument for how it would be reused. Mm-hmm. To people talk about food halls and that kind of stuff. Well, this was a place where it had a food court that went out of business, basically. And you can maybe argue that, well, it wasn't managed well, whatever. But there has not been a real demand in downtown to sustain that kind of a business. So, I mean, if you went in and kept it and then remodeled it and reconfigured it and put it back on the market, what if it flops? You know, then you got the Berkman problem all over again, which is you still have a problem that hasn't been solved.
On the flip side, these festival marketplaces have been repurposed in other cities successfully. Right. So that's the other side of the argument, that it can be done if with the right approach, with the right concept.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who's been through that landing knows it suffered from a lack of basic upkeep. You know, it just didn't have the kind of things you would want to do in your house to keep it a nice place to live. And that happened over a period of many, many years. Norfolk, I think, is the one I've heard the most, where you had something that was very much like the landing. Ironically, the Cordish Companies, which is doing the development that Shad mm-hmm. Khan's doing over the sports complex, they were hired in Norfolk. They went in. Now, they got some good taxpayer incentives. This was not done just out of their own pocket. And they've really reimagined and recreated that place. It's a place where, as I understand it, it draws people from downtown, from out of downtown. It's become a real gathering space, which is ultimately what you want for that property in downtown Jacksonville.
Lots of calls. Let's go to Jackie in Arlington. Hey, Jackie, how are you? Go ahead.
I'm okay. My concern is thinking about the residents and homeowners in Arlington by Regency, because we've already started seeing some of the homeless migrating over the bridge into our neighborhoods, literally into our neighborhoods, as well as by the shopping areas where we are. So everyone is thinking about demolishing businesses, demolishing old buildings and building up businesses in downtown, but are you considering the homeless downtown? And what are you going to do about the homeless? Where are they going to go? Are y'all going to disregard them and let them just migrate into the neighborhoods?
Thanks, Jackie. Yeah, that is another aspect of this, because we do have a significant homeless population, mainly downtown and also at the beaches. And despite all of the efforts to reduce that population, get people housed, get people services, we continue to have this issue. And what about the argument that if you open up more green space on the river, homeless people will go there? And then the deeper question, which is, why can't this city more adequately help this population, like most other cities, to be fair?
Right. I think in terms of the homeless population downtown, obviously at the daytime, they come out of the shelters and they walk around downtown. And that's going to happen in any city. So I don't know that it's necessarily a problem with the adequate care. There is a large homeless population. Being able to reduce the population, find people with more stable housing would be a good thing. As far as the landing, if it were to become green space, turning into sort of just a place where it's like a day's place where the homeless people hang out. Potentially, I guess that could happen. I don't have as many concerns about that maybe as some people do, just because I do think it's going to be a place where there's going to be a lot of other people there. I've always been persuaded by this argument that all major U.S. cities have homeless people. They just become more visible in places where there's not a lot of other activity outside.
Yeah.
This area where if they were to turn it into a park, it would be heavily patrolled, I'm sure, by police. There'd be a lot of folks out there with eyes on the property. And look, you're going to have other activity out there. It's not just going to be a park. There's going to be other commercial enterprises going on there. Now, what happens at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night? No, maybe you're less comfortable walking through it during those hours. That's probably true of a lot of different parks around downtown.
Patrick at the beaches. Patrick, what say you?
Hi. Several years ago, I visited Guayaquil, Ecuador. And it reminded me oddly of Jacksonville because it's a large coastal city with a river running through it. And I don't know, about 15, 17 years ago, the city of Guayaquil built this massive pedestrian promenade. It's about a mile and a half long. Mm-hmm. And when I visited that spot, I thought, this is exactly what Jacksonville needs. It had an IMAX theater. It had a yacht club. It had restaurants. The entire thing had a wrought iron fence on one side and the river on the other side. It had limited access with obvious security, but you didn't feel like you were in a police state. Mm. And ever since I've been there, I thought that's exactly what the North Bank of Jacksonville needs. It could incorporate several of the locations people have been talking about, and it actually would get people down there. It would be a really, really magnificent draw to downtown Jacksonville.
Thanks for that, Patrick. Mm. Yeah, that's a... Those are the kind of big ideas that people have floated for years. But all of the energy, as you've been reporting, David, those kinds of big splashy centers with a lot of interconnected attractions is almost certainly now going to shift east to the stadium, not along the North Bank so much, downtown anyway.
For people who really follow downtown, that's one of the criticisms of the focus on the sports complex is that it's kind of an island up to itself. It's pretty far away. If you're talking about a walkable downtown, that's a pretty long walk if you want to go from the center of downtown all the way out to the sports complex. But, you know, what the guy's talking about in terms of a pedestrian plaza, that's interesting. I mean, they tried to do that a little bit with Laura Street, which from Hemming Park to the Landing, they've tried to make it more pedestrian friendly. There have been over the years ideas of just saying, let's make it just pedestrians only.
Cities all over the world have done that with great success, making a pedestrian only strip. And there's always been a lot of hue and cry and naysayers saying that's a terrible idea. But in the end, they almost always become massive draws.
Yeah,
and have been successful all in cities worldwide. So, yeah. That is something that the obvious place to do that would be Laura Street. Close it to traffic, make a pedestrian promenade, and build it up so much so that it draws people in from the suburbs just to walk and enjoy and shop and eat. You'd have sidewalk. You have sidewalk cafes because you don't have cars, so it's easier to do it. And there's it just completely changes the way people interact with the built environment.
Well, personally, I think it'd be a great idea. I'm sure there's probably logistics as far as traffic and everything, but they do it somewhat on Art Walk once a month already. It's a great experience to be able to walk and not look over your shoulder, worry about cars next to you. And really, that part of downtown would be a fantastic place to do it.
Bobby on the north side. Hi, Bobby. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Yes, couple of issues. The Whole Lot J and Cordish redevelopment, the sticking point of that is the environmental remediation from all the contaminant. As I understand it, Lot J was allowed to be built there because it covered up contaminants. So we're going to be stuck with a pretty huge bill for that, which I'm sure Shad's going to pass on to the city because it's not really his problem. It's a legacy issue. And I would think that the courthouse property would make as far as moving things closer to the stadium, to build something similar to the Landing with some transient boat parking or in a parking garage dedicated just to that. And then let them turn the Landing into a green space.
Thanks, Bobby. Thanks for all that. Yeah. And he's right. Beginning with his first point, before they can build anything on Lot J, there will be some significant remediation work that has to be done.
Absolutely. He's right. It used to be a petroleum tank farm. There's some great photos we've run in the newspaper kind of showing what it was like then versus what it's like now. So there's stuff underneath that's got to be taken care of in terms of complying with environmental regulations. There's also, I think, a lot of just debris, stuff that was buried there back in the day when it was an industrial shipyard's property. So that would be on the city's dime, I'm sure. That's not something that the Jaguars and Shad Khan are going to pay for. You know, what he's talking about in terms of the area where the old county courthouse is, yeah, that's a fascinating area for redevelopment. At one point, they talked about a convention center there. Then they pulled the plug on that. So if and when there's a convention center built in Jacksonville, it looks like it would likely be in the area of the sports complex, if that ever happens.
Speaking of the sports complex, here's an email. So if Lot J is subject to flooding, one of the reasons JEA chose a higher location downtown for its headquarters, what's it going to cost to keep flooding out of Lot J, and who will pay for it? And this is something that we've covered on this program, not just Khan's plans for Lot J on the North Bank, but the district development on the South Bank and any building that goes on near or on the water. There, if a developer chooses to protect the property, it's their choice. There's no requirement that they do so. And in that sense, this city is behind a lot of other municipalities who are factoring in sustainability and water rise into their into the way they allow development to proceed, David. And you would think after Hurricane Irma especially, right, more thought would be given to that, but it's not.
Right. So in terms of the sports complex and Lot J, one thing you might look at is what the building elevation is going to be. How much are they going to be built off the ground so that if there is flood water, how high does it have to get before it gets into the building itself? That might be something that they'll look at. And I don't know that there's anything mandates them to do that. It seems like it would make sense. Now, if you get even closer to the river, which is the Met Park Shipyards place, there you're even more at risk of flooding. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there. I understand they've looked at different things to try and mitigate against the impact of flooding there. But if you're going to put, let's do the math, if you're talking about a $2.5 billion development and $500,000 of it's on Lot J, that means $2 billion of it is going to be closer to the river. That's a lot of investment, both private and public. You probably want to make sure that it's not going to get not wiped away, but not heavily damaged whenever we have these floods that come from hurricane storm surge, which we've seen is reality. It's not hypothetical.
Yeah, it's something we'll continue to follow here on this program. And we thank you so much for joining us. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Always appreciate your reporting. Thank you.
We did get back to Earth Day there at the end, so that was good.
That's right.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah, happy Earth Day, everybody. Follow that hashtag on social media, by the way, to see some stunning photos all over the planet, beautiful nature images. Up next, Matthew Sandusky's brave story and his effort to advocate for victims of child sexual abuse, a preview of his talk in Jacksonville this week. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We will be right back.
UF Health Proton Therapy Institute, an accredited cancer treatment center in Jacksonville, with over 12 years of experience in proton therapy, making positive advances in patient outcomes. More at floridaproton.org.
Sight and Sound Productions. Planning a meeting or conference? Why stress out before the big day? Imagine the freedom to focus your energy and enjoy your hard work. Audio, video, lighting, and peace of mind. SSAV.net.
Hi, it's Robin Young, co-host of Here and Now, Public Radio's live midday news program, now on 89.9 FM WJCT. Join me and Jeremy Hobson beginning Monday, April 29th at 1 p.m. to hear news as it's happening. Timely, in-depth news, interviews, and conversation.
Welcome back. Well, the name Jerry Sandusky was once respected in the sports world. It is now notorious everywhere. Sandusky, the former Penn State football coach, is now serving a life sentence for abusing young boys over a period of decades. Matthew Sandusky was one of those boys. He was a foster child before becoming one of Sandusky's six adopted children. Today, Matthew's an adult, an author, and a speaker. And he shines a light on how even highly respected members of a community can often hide behind their position to commit crimes on vulnerable children. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Matthew Sandusky will be the keynote speaker this week at the Child Abuse Prevention Conference and Luncheon, sponsored by the Exchange Club of Jacksonville. Matthew Sandusky is also founder and executive director of the Peaceful Hearts Foundation and author of the book Undaunted. And he's on the line now with more. Matthew Sandusky, a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, well, good morning, and thank you for having me.
And, you know, most of us know the story of your adoptive father, Jerry Sandusky, but we haven't heard your story to quite the same volume. So it's really wonderful to have you on the program as you can share your story. It's all in the pages of your book, Undaunted, Breaking My Silence to Overcome the Trauma of Child Sexual Abuse. And you unsparingly tell the story of what happened to you in your experience in the Sandusky home, beginning with the grooming process of children, how kids are groomed and then eventually victimized. Why is it so important for people to understand how pedophiles operate in this way and how actions that can seem innocuous are really diabolical? This is something I think that's still not very well understood by a lot of people. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how your experience has informed your understanding of that?
Yeah, absolutely. The most important thing that any of us can understand about child abuse in general, but specifically child sexual victimization, is what it truly means, you know, when we say grooming. And to break it down quite simply, grooming, they're really just the tactics that a perpetrator uses to gain access to the child and then gain control over that child. And then, you know, the tactics that they use to maintain that control. But they also groom communities. They groom the parents of the child that they're going after. They groom, you know, everybody. And the person who perpetrated and sexually victimized me is one of the most prolific, you know, child sex crimes groomers to ever exist because of what he was able to do and how many people he was able to fool with this portrait of what he painted himself out to be and we all bought.
Right. And he was able to fool the public for many years. Finally, there were so many victims that the outcry became so great that he was finally held accountable. And it's so alarming to read about this story because, you know, you wonder if there's somebody that you've come in contact with in your own life, your own community, maybe your workplace or school, who is behaving this way in secret. People can be very good at hiding their behavior. And so what can we as bystanders do to better protect children and become aware of red flags, seeing that something's not right with the way an adult is interacting with children? What were the signs that were missed when it came to Jerry Sandusky?
Well, as it relates to him specifically, you know, he dedicated his life to children. That's you know, the portrait that he was painting. And nothing was more important to him than children. And that's how these perpetrators operate. They put themselves in positions where they will be around children, where they will have power over children, and where they can seem saintly almost. You know, they'll offer to take a child home. They'll offer to, you know, spend extra time with the child and work with them on their schoolwork, or if it's a sports team, work, you know, extra in those areas. And these are the types of things that he did as well. You know, taking us to a locker room to work out, helping educate us, getting us tutors, you know, wrestling around in open locker rooms where other people would see, and he would involve other people in those innocuous type behaviors. And so that as a child, what he was doing behind closed doors, the things that were crimes against us, you know, we were seeing as possibly, you know, it must be okay because everybody else is involved in these other things. And that's really how they operate. And the grooming process is a step-by-step process as well. They start, you know, for me, it was with a simple conversation that led to a hand on the knee in the car that, you know, and he pushed boundaries further and further. And mm-hmm. for us as adults, specifically, we need to educate ourselves. We really need to understand how these people operate, but we also need to understand what an abused child looks like and, you know, what that means when we say that, so that we can step in and do something. And the most important thing that I can tell anybody, adult or child, is always listen to your gut. If something doesn't seem right, if something doesn't feel right, then there's absolutely a reason you're feeling that way. And if you think a child is being hurt or abused in any type of way, you have to step up and you have to step in and you have to report that.
Right. In that sense, we are all mandated reporters, not just teachers or law enforcement. That's right. And, you know, I have to applaud your courage, Matthew. You were one of many boys that Jerry was convicted of abusing. 8 victims testified during his trial. Dozens more told their stories. They came forward to the media. You initially stuck by Jerry, but in the middle of his trial, you came out with your story. And many believe that played a big role in the conviction of Sandusky and his eventual sentencing, your courage in coming forward. What was it that motivated you to go from staying silent to deciding to come forward with your story?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the first thing that I would say to that is that truly and wholeheartedly, the men who testified against their perpetrator at the trial are the reason that he was convicted and put away. For me, their courage showed me and empowered me that I could speak my truth. And that's what I did. The second day of trial, I went to the prosecutors and told them that I also was a victim. And I never had any intention of coming forward, you know, publicly, but the recording of my confession, I guess we'll call it, or disclosure, was leaked to the media by the defense team. And then the Good Morning America shows across the nation played it, you know, without my approval or my permission. So that they kind of took, you know, my public disclosure away. But ultimately, it was the courage of those young men that were testifying, you know, in that courtroom that empowered me. And that is wholeheartedly the reason that I do what I'm doing now. It's to mm-hmm. hopefully empower others to find their voices, to speak their truth, and to understand that it wasn't their fault. They had nothing, you know, no part in that, and that, you know, it's going to be okay. And you're not alone. A lot of us go through this.
And in fact, after you appeared on Oprah Winfrey and you became an in-demand speaker, you have gone further. You've also formed a foundation with your wife. It's called the Peaceful Hearts Foundation that helps victims of child sexual abuse. Can you tell us a little bit more about the foundation work?
Yeah, absolutely. My wife and I, Kim, founded Peaceful Hearts Foundation. And we don't have a program. We have no programming. So what we are truly is an advocacy organization around the issue of child sexual victimization and a community for survivors of child sex crimes. And those are really where we try and focus. And part of my speaking and everything that I do, obviously, is part of Peaceful Hearts. And it's really, truly just an outreach and education platform to be able to get people to start to understand this issue and why it is so important that we actually, you know, put it at the forefront of what we're looking at.
I applaud you speaking out because Child sex abuse thrives in secrecy and silence. It's important for people to bear witness, isn't it? And talk about this publicly and openly and compassionately.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's what I'm trying to push for. That's what I'm trying. And not only myself, but there are hundreds of other advocates like myself who have experienced this and who have not. But we understand and we know that the only way that we can truly protect children is to bring all of this darkness into the light. We have to start talking about it in public domain. And really, as I said before, we have to make it a huge topic of discussion. And when we look at child sexual victimization, it is the number one health epidemic that we face as a nation, but it is rarely talked about. And I understand it's very difficult to talk about. We don't want to talk about, you know, these heinous things that are happening, you know, to these children. And we focus on the sexual aspects of what child sexual victimization is, but we don't truly understand that what's at play is the power dynamic. You know, one person has power over another person. And even to take that outside of just the, you know, this issue, and we could put that into our society. And that's one avenue that we need to truly look at and see how we combat that if we want to get to really ending and protecting children, but ending child sexual victimization.
And you write and talk about how a person who's highly respected can hide behind their position. Before we go to break, I know your experience was with Jerry Sandusky, but when HBO screened the documentary Leaving Neverland about Michael Jackson's abuse of young boys and how he was exposed as a pedophile, that shocked and upset many fans of the late singer. But I think it was also illustrative of what you're saying, that people who seem to be have a persona that's presented one way to the public can behave very differently in private. Did that resonate with you as well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's who these people are. And I think that's why it's important to truly understand who the perpetrators are. In schools, we obviously teach children stranger danger and, you know, those types of things, which are great for us to be teaching children. But when we do that, we're doing, you know, and we don't teach the other side of it, of, you know, community, pillars of the community and nice guy type offenders. We're doing a huge disservice to children and ourselves by not educating ourselves of what that means and as to who these people truly are, because 93 to 95% of all child sexual victimization is perpetrated against the child by someone that they already know, love, and care about. So it's important to really understand, you know, as I said before, how these people place themselves in our society around children in positions where they're going to have access to children and, you know, where they can do these things and the behaviors and tactics that they will use to do that. And we need to stop putting people on pedestals based on, you know, positions.
Their positions, sure.
Jobs that they hold.
Yes.
And when we do that, then we can actually start getting somewhere.
Matthew Sandusky, author of Undaunted and executive director of the Peaceful Hearts Foundation, thank you so much for being with us. Matthew speaks Wednesday at UNF at the Child Abuse Prevention Conference and Luncheon, sponsored by the Exchange Club of Jacksonville. For more, go to exchangeclubfamilycenter.com. That's on Wednesday. And up next, it's draft week for the Jaguars and the NFL. Culpepper steps in right after this.
It's Robin Young, co-host of Here and Now. Next week, join me and Jeremy Hobson on 89.9 FM WJCT at 1 p.m. We feature interviews with newsmakers, NPR reporters, innovators, artists from across the U.S. and around the world. Join us.
Last month, huge parts of the Midwest were underwater, including a million acres of farmland.
Yeah, a lot of farmers are still debating whether or not they should try to plant a crop this year, but we don't really have that option because there's still 2 to 3 to 5 feet of water.
I'm Kai Ruzdahl. How are you going to keep them on the farm when it's underwater? That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
The Don and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art Complex in Sarasota includes a 21-gallery museum, the Katazan Mansion, the Oslo Theater, and the Circus Museum. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will explore the Ringling legacy. The 1914 Confederate reunion in Jacksonville, and a history of the Green Book on Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Millions manipulated, thousands of emails stolen, state organizations hacked, and campaign staff corrupted. Robert Mueller laid out just how far Russia went to interfere in our last presidential election. How do you feel about that? And what should happen now? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back, finally, this hour. It's draft week for the Jaguars and the NFL.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
The Jaguars hold the number 7 pick. What does that mean for the franchise? Cole Pepper, of course, has some thoughts. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Well, I think we have to start with what the Jaguars need, where their biggest areas of need are. And I would say those are, in no particular order, wide receiver, tight end, and right tackle, the most glaring areas right now. Here are the issues with that, though. There is no wide receiver likely to go in the top 10. Maybe one would go in the top 20, but I don't think anybody's going to be a top 10, so I don't think the Jaguars are going there. There are some very good tight ends in the draft, but it's rare to have one drafted in the top 10. In fact, only 5 tight ends have been top 10 picks since 1981. One of those, by the way, Kyle Brady, when the Jets took him in the top 10 before he wound up joining the Jaguars. Right tackle could happen. There are 2 or 3 offensive tackles who could go in the top 10, including Florida's right tackle, Juwan Taylor. He's been the most common prediction by draft analysts around the country to wind up with the Jaguars. So that's one position where the Jaguars could address in the draft. And I will say as well, offensive linemen typically can be very good in their first years in the National Football League if they've played at a high level, which obviously playing in the SEC, Taylor has done just that. All right, what about a quarterback, though? A lot of folks looking at quarterbacks each and every year. I think it's possible the Jaguars draft a quarterback, but not in the first round. After signing Nick Foles, they're not going to draft a quarterback. Maybe not even the second or third round, but I can see a quarterback being picked at some point throughout the course of the draft Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So who are they likely to choose? I think they could actually go with a defensive lineman here as well. And you would say, well, defense is already good. Why wouldn't you address another position? Remember, the Jaguars lost Dante Fowler to a trade late last year, and he was sort of the third component of those pass rushers with Yannick Ngakoue and Calais Campbell. I think with all the talent they have in this draft at defensive line, that's a very likely position for the Jaguars to address. And Tom Coughlin always likes to have guys who can get after the quarterback. The first year he won a Super Bowl with the Giants, he had 4 pass rushers on his defensive line, guys who could all play defensive end. So I think that's certainly an area where they could go. I think it'll come down to Juwan Taylor, Montez Sweat, who's the fastest defensive lineman in NFL draft history, Rashawn Gary from Michigan, another defensive lineman, or TJ Hawkinson. And I would say you could also throw in Jonah Williams there, the versatile offensive lineman from Alabama. One of those guys likely to be the pick. I really like Sweat, but there are some concerns about him having an enlarged heart. It did not keep him from having double-digit sacks in the SEC each of the last 2 years. So we'll see how that all plays out. They really get down to the nitty-gritty on the details when this time of year rolls around.
I always wonder what goes on behind the scenes. I picture scenes similar to the movie Jerry Maguire, where there's all kinds of backstabbing and drama.
You know what happens this time of year? It's in the let's say 2 or 3 weeks leading up to the draft. You have more misinformation and disinformation being floated than actual information. Some teams really do dabble in this. And one of the reasons why this week we're seeing, this past week we started seeing stories about Sweat falling, that probably means that somebody who is in the mid of the first round, and the team somewhere really wants him and wants to plant a seed that he's falling. So other teams go, why is he falling?
Why?
And
propaganda so efforts.
It really is. And it's intriguing to see how some of that happens on a on an annual basis.
Okay. Let's recap the Jaguars' state of the franchise from last Thursday. Four big things stood out to you. The stadium stuff, obviously, but also some team stuff.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about what football impact comes from the state of the franchise, it's usually fairly negligible. But this year with Tom Coughlin basically calling out Jalen Ramsey and Telvin Smith without saying their names, saying that we should have 100% participation in the voluntary offseason workout program. Smith's agent, or rather Ramsey's agent, and then Ramsey followed up by saying, yes, we understand what voluntary means. Both are right and both are wrong in this, by the way. Yes, it is voluntary, and Jalen Ramsey doesn't have to be here. Telvin Smith doesn't have to be here. But it is an opportunity for those guys to be here and build camaraderie with their new teammates and their existing teammates as well. Coughlin, though, should not have thrown those two players under the bus publicly. If you're going to do it, go ahead and get them on the phone or text them or whatever it might be. But to throw them under the bus publicly, I thought was about, beyond the line.
Interesting. Okay, what about the stadium renovations? That took some reporters at the event by surprise, how extensive they apparently are going to be.
Well, I would say that the stadium renovations from a stadium standpoint is still in the hypothetical stage. They know the challenge that they have with people who sit in the east side of the stadium, particularly in the upper deck, but not only in the upper deck. And one of the thoughts was, well, let's provide some shade somehow. If you remember, 3 or 4 years ago, there was a schematic done, an architectural rendering of the stadium with a retractable roof going over the top of it. We haven't seen that since in the state of the franchise addresses. But Shad Khan did say that he thought there was an interesting idea that they had talked about in Qatar for the World Cup of having drones hold a sunshade and move it so that the...
Can you imagine?
Well, this is what you get when you have an engineer and a developer as your team owner.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept. As long as the drones don't fall out of the sky, I think that would be great to be able to provide a little bit of shade for those folks on the east side who really, especially early in the season, can just absolutely get pounded with the hot late summer sun.
So more than one kind of shade being thrown
this
event.
Yeah, like what you did there.
Yes. Okay. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Watch him every night on Channel 4, our news partner, and listen to him every Monday morning here on this show. Thanks so much for being here, as always.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. And on tomorrow's show, Dining Out for Life. That's tomorrow. We'll see you then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.